American League, Cleveland and Detroit, Kansas City and the Yankees, all the series are tied at 1-1. Today's forecast now from the National Weather Service, sunny and pleasant, a high of 70. Right now, 52 in Racine, 51 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Recently, I have been reading a beautiful book called As the Rivers Merge, a story of love, war, and perseverance across continents. The cover is an intriguing juxtaposition of two very dramatically contrasting images. One out of the heart of rural Africa, the other a European skyline. The one is Nigeria, the other Budapest, Hungary. And it is the story of Daniel Mama's parents, his father from Nigeria, his mother from Hungary, both enduring all kinds of tumult in the worlds in which they were born and raised and lived. And the story of how they came together, the life they built together, and the way in which they managed to rise above so much difficulty is told beautifully in this book. The author, Daniel Mama, their son, is a medical doctor. He's actually professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, and a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. And this book, A Labor of Love, which he has taken many years to complete, is now available, published by Fish Eagle Press. Dr. Daniel Mama, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
You tell us at the outset that your first thoughts about writing this book occurred to you back in 2012. Explain what was going on in your life at that moment, and what got you thinking about the possibility of writing some sort of book about your parents?
Well, in 2012, we were going through a major change in our lives. That was when my wife was pregnant with our first child. And that was really the inspiration for this book. My parents, sadly, are no longer with us. They passed away about 27 years ago. And when my wife was pregnant with our first child, it hit me that my children are not going to, they're not going to know who their grandparents were. They're not going to have the childhood experiences with their grandparents that many of us had. And I wanted to find some way that I could compensate for that. And writing a book seemed to make the most sense. And that could give them a way to learn about their parents, learn about the beautiful stories that they had.
You tell us that your initial idea was going to be a book written very much from your perspective of your life with your parents. And then ultimately you were moved away from that initial idea to writing a book that is largely about your mother and your father before you ever came on the scene. Explain that shift.
Yeah. So that when you're writing a book about someone's life, especially someone who you know, you could write it from a variety of different perspectives, right? So we often think about memoirs where you write about your experiences with your parents and how you saw them. And that was how I initially wanted to write this. I thought about writing it from my perspective, using my memories, what I thought about how they perceived the world. But then when I was doing research over the last several years, I came across a lot of information, personal letters, hundreds of letters that my relatives, my aunts, my grandmother kept. And I really got deep insights into the way my parents thought, what their dreams were, what their challenges were. And I felt it would make a lot more sense if I wrote the book from their perspective, because I had enough information where I could narrate that. And so that was how I decided to go from my perspective to both my parents' perspectives. Mm. And by the way, the book is sort of written in an alternative point of view format. So one chapter is from my father's perspective, and then my mother, and back and forth in that sort of way.
All right. Let's talk first about your father, Matthew, who was probably lucky to survive the Civil War in Nigeria. One of the intriguing things is that this is a very, very difficult time for his homeland, and yet it was, in some respects, a time of optimism. Explain how both of those things could be true. That is, that Nigeria was upended by this very painful civil war, and yet somehow there was a spirit of optimism in the air.
Yeah, so in 1960, Nigeria gained independence from Great Britain, and as you can imagine, there was a lot of celebration. Everyone was optimistic and felt like anything was possible. But that was soon followed by a series of politically turbulent events, including multiple civil wars. The first prime minister was assassinated in broad daylight. And so the country, despite this optimism, started to become more fearful and pessimism started to creep in. And then eventually the civil war crept in and the civil war was largely between the Nigerian government and a smaller faction that wanted to break away from Nigeria. And that was a really difficult time in the country's history. And that was when a lot of people started to believe that the country is not going to move in the right direction. And that was around the time that my dad left the country. Hmm.
Meanwhile, your mother grows up in Hungary. She is a musician and, in fact, the grandniece of perhaps Hungary's greatest composer, Béla Bartók. And yet she, unfortunately, does not have the life that she hoped because of the rise of communism there, that painful revolution and doors being shut to her in terms of her hopes of becoming a music teacher. Tell us about that struggle for your mother, Judith.
That was one of the difficulties with communism that we often don't think about, is how much restrictions it came with. My mother wanted to be a music teacher. She loved children. She loved to sing and play some instruments. And she wasn't able to do that because she was very religious. And religion and communism were not compatible. And because she was attending a lot of religious classes in school, and it was very clear that she was a devout Catholic, she was restricted from going to teaching school. And this was a very devastating time for my mom. But imagine having a lifelong goal that's just snatched away from you for no good reason. But eventually she decided to go into a career in chemical engineering. And that was how she ended up meeting my dad. Hmm.
Explain the events that brought your father to Hungary for the first time and the circumstances under which your mother and father met.
Yeah, so my dad got an educational scholarship to study abroad, and he happened to get one to Hungary, a country that he'd never heard of before. And so he came to Hungary to study chemical engineering. My mom was also a chemical engineer, and they happened to meet one summer during an elective. And my dad was assigned to my mom, under my mom's supervision. And they got to meet each other, and that was where the magic happened.
Hmm. One of my favorite passages in the book is where you describe some of what your father experienced as he was first there. And first of all, he is thinking as he looks around that there's a whole lot in Budapest that is not completely unknown or unfamiliar. I mean, and of course, people are people. And so there are sights and sounds that surprisingly feel like home. And then you write, and then he saw the water. Matthew knew water. He'd grown up around water. Just a short walk from his dormitory, he thought the Danube would ground him in its familiarity. But while the clean, squared-off lines of the housing complex reminded him of a few of Port Harcourt's business buildings, the river was unlike anything he'd seen before. As clear as a mirror, the city's majestic buildings seemed to gaze at themselves in its reflection. While the river felt unfamiliar in its grandeur, it also felt reassuring. He felt safe here. I just love the way that's written. It's just beautiful. And it's as though you were there. And, of course, you weren't there. But you seem to somehow know exactly what your father was feeling in this important moment.
Yeah, I mean, this is why some of the interviews that I did and looking through documents and historical texts allowed me to put together a narrative that what reflected how my dad felt, or very likely felt at the time. But yes, that was a very, very memorable time for my dad, I would imagine. He lived he came from a part of Nigeria that was almost entirely water. In fact, there were almost no roads, believe it or not, in the villages that he lived in. And so people commuted by canoe. And so, when he ended up going to Hungary, you can imagine that it was a culture shock and seeing all these buildings. But yeah, the water was one thing that was very familiar to him. He that was his home. He loved swimming. He loved being around water. And I'm sure that was one of the reasons that he ended up really loving Hungary.
Hmm. Well, and of course, speaking of love, he and your mother fell rather quickly in love, although not immediately, but I think you also describe the story of their courtship and their love and ultimately their marriage so beautifully. What was it like for you to look through your mother's letters and other journals and interviewing family members? What was it like to come to know your own parents in this way at a time when they were not your parents because you weren't there yet? But, I mean, I think it's sometimes really interesting for people to come to an understanding about their own parents at a time when they were young and in love.
Yeah, I will say that I had goosebumps several times learning about their history, especially some of the history about how they met, some of those private moments. But it was really a great feeling. I mean, it was I learned so much in writing this book that I never thought that I would ever know about them. And I feel really grateful that I had this opportunity.
Hmm. I love one moment in the book when your father is back in Port Harcourt and seeing signs of difficulty, but seeing signs of resilience as well. You write, almost as in defiance, the city had begun to straighten its spine and throw its shoulders back. In the face of disappointment, he'd gathered his strength and set one foot in front of the other. And in some respects, that's the heart and soul of your parents' story, of facing so much difficulty, barriers of one kind or another, misunderstanding, outright bigotry, and just moving forward so powerfully, so relentlessly, and so joyously.
Yes, I mean, resilience is really one of the themes of the book. And one of the things, when I was writing this, I was really amazed at how do you go through so much difficulty in your life and still stand, still keep moving. And it's one of the reasons I really feel like this book would be an inspiration to people, because it makes people realize that you can get through difficult situations, even though they seem almost impossible to overcome.
Right. And I'm very touched by one of the last lines in the book. At this point in time, you and your siblings are trying to come to terms with the death of your parents in a tragic accident. And we see these words, "As their parents before them, they," meaning you and your siblings, "would endure the world's fallout and embrace its blessings." The book again is As the Rivers Merge, a story of love, war, and perseverance across continents, published by Fish Eagle Press, and the author, Dr. Daniel Mama. Dr. Mama, congratulations on a job well done with this beautifully crafted book, and thank you for being my Morning Show guest.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. For this portion of today's Morning Show here on WGTD, we are going back into the Morning Show archives all the way back to 2003 for one of my all-time favorite interviews with a psychotherapist by the name of Janet Malamud Smith. And we are talking about a book called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. In this book, Janet Malamud Smith explores the phenomenon of parents and particularly mothers who parent with an overarching sense of fear and even dread that something truly terrible might happen to their child. It is the contention of Janet Malamud Smith that this fear, which of course is based in reality, can sometimes go way too far, and that fear is stoked by an entire industry that exists and, in a sense, preys upon the vulnerabilities of parents and their fear that something might happen to their precious children. She also contends that this is something that has gone on for a long, long time. And she offers all kinds of helpful suggestions in her book about how parents can be respectful of such realities and mindful of them without allowing such fears to, in a sense, overrun common sense and ultimately be counterproductive in all kinds of different ways. The book again is called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear.
Janet Malamud Smith, you are a mother of two sons, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And tell me, first of all, the intersection between your own real life, your own personal experience as a mother, with this topic that you were examining. To what extent did you allow your own life and experience to have any bearing on this particular work?
Oh, it had so much bearing. First of all, I have a sort of theory that nonfiction books are always answers that writers hold secretly inside them, no matter how far the real topic is. But this one was really close to me. When my sons were born, I was staggered by how much it turned my life on its head. I hadn't expected, I'd expected to love them and stuff, but I hadn't expected to suddenly find my whole world revolving around the access of their safety and well-being. And so the degree to which that compelled me really became the center of this book. And I wanted to understand both whether what I was feeling was something that a lot of other mothers felt, which of course it was, and what it meant to be so consumed with my children's safety. And then I began to explore and try and understand what it meant in larger ways that mothers so usually put their children first. I don't mean that mothers are angels or mothers are wonderful, but that once a mother attaches to a child, she will sort of tie herself into pretzels trying to keep that child safe. And that's what the book explores.
Well, and then you want to examine then, as you say it, how this maybe unconsidered determinant of women's history has worked. That the way that women have lived out their lives, what they have accomplished or not accomplished beyond parenthood, perhaps has something to do with this.
Exactly. And one of the things that just sort of took me over as I was doing research for the book, and I've spent a lot of my life reading history and looking at the past in different ways, but one of the things that took me over was the question of why is it that in most of the world today, mothers are still doing more hours of work for less compensation, don't get as good nutrition in poor countries as husbands, for example, or men, are unequal on almost every scale that we can measure in, and why has this been the norm since the beginning of time? And why have we been so slow to think about issues of making mothers equal citizens in any society? I mean, even in America, you know, it's maybe 100 years since we've had adequate birth control, 100 years since we've let women into colleges, less than 100 years since we've allowed women the vote. So why is this such a slow-growing thing? And as I began to think about this, I realized it came together with this the intensity of what I call the mother's alarm system and this compulsion to put children first. And I felt these two phenomena were related. And the book is really an exploration of that relationship.
One of the pictures that you draw, we should hasten to add that one of the best things about this book is that you take us back into history and Greek drama and to early childcare manuals and so on. But to me, one of the most enduring pictures from this book is a very simple and contemporary one. You tell us or paint for us the picture of a pregnant woman with a couple of young kids in tow crossing the street. And you talk about how in trying to do that and keeping everybody together, she is hobbled. And you draw such a beautiful parallel between that and what life can be for a mother who is contending with all of the challenges of being a good mother.
That's right. You've said it so well. And I think that the woman, if you imagine that mom who's pregnant with a toddler in each hand trying to cross the street, it was a metaphor I used to try and capture succinctly the amount of vulnerability that you have when all of a sudden you're looking after a colony instead of simply yourself, and what it means to try and move a group or protect a group or think for a group or feed a group, and how profoundly that changes you when suddenly it's not just about you. And it's exactly that image that sort of captures why I think it is that mothers have remained in such an unequal position. May I tell you another mother story that's
yes.
in the book? One of my favorites was told to me. One of the great things about writing this book was that mothers just started telling me stories when I would tell them what I was writing about. And this was a woman who was well into her 60s, and her son was grown and came home one day as a 25-year-old with a friend of his. And the mom and dad had just in their retirement or that phase of life bought a motorboat. And the son decided that he wanted to go out into the ocean with the motorboat. And so not feeling she could stop him, because that seemed the wrong thing to do to a 25-year-old, she said, okay. And she didn't let them go, and, you know, she went about her day, but she realized that in the back of her mind, every second she was going, okay, how much gas is in the gas tank? Do they have the charts of the bay? Do they know what the riptide does? Do they know when the high tide comes? Do they know when the low tide comes? Well, what about those rocks over in the corner? And the kids didn't come back, and it got darker and darker and later, and her husband went to sleep, and she was just fretting and fretting and fretting. So finally she took a flashlight. She walked across her yard down to the dock, walked out on the dock at about 10 at night, and stood there with the flashlight on over her head, making herself into a beacon to help her boy and his friend come home. Now, they made it safely, but this is the other image that I think so captures what I'm trying to talk about in the book, about what a mom will do and how silly we all feel sometimes to the extent we'll go to create the safety for our children.
You mentioned at one point that the passion we feel towards infants, children's adolescents, defies reason. and every imposed idea about how it ought to be. The idea that we're not talking necessarily about a reasonable feeling, but an unreasonable feeling.
Precisely. We're talking about an alarm system, I think, that's so deeply in us, that is so at the heart of who we are as people and as mothers, that it sometimes triggers and acts and carries us into feeling states and action before we even know that our buttons have been pushed.
One of the really intriguing, I don't want to call it a contradiction, but one of the sort of, I don't know, factual rubs, let's say, is that, of course, once upon a time, infant mortality was tragically high all over the world. And increasingly, at least in the United States, we can give thanks that infants do not perish at the rate that they once did, and that by and large, our children are much safer than they once were. Their real safety is indeed improved. But you go on to say then that despite this, mothers do not seem to be any more at ease than they once were. And you cite, I think, three different basic reasons why mothers continue to live their lives as mothers with such a heightened sense of fear. Let's talk about what those three factors are.
Well, I'm honestly not positive which three you're referring to, but let me tell you the ones that come to my mind now, and maybe you can fill in the one I missed.
Sure.
The first thing is that just staggered me when I wrote the book, and I started really looking at infant mortality and child mortality, and also infant and child abandonment, which is another whole amazing phenomenon in history. But what I discovered that was just incredible was that when infant mortality dramatically goes down in the United States right at the end of the 19th century, mostly not through improvements of medicine, but because we've managed to learn to cover the sewers, though, of course, medicine and nutrition play into it eventually as well. But the second that the infant and child mortality go down, without losing a beat, the people who give advice to mothers, all the people who write the advice books that I ended up reading, change over from threatening mothers with the death of children, which has been the Norman advice books up to then, to threatening them with the psychological maiming of children if they don't do a good enough job. So one of the reasons that mothers get no relief is because the public voices that are advising mothers do not say, gee, this is great, look how much safer you guys have, your kids are. You moms go out and have a good time and go earn a living and have fun with your friends. Instead, the advice givers say, oh, yeah, we've saved some lives now, but moms, watch out. If you love your kid even a little bit wrong, you're going to destroy them for life.
Yes, you can do still better.
That's right. So that's one reason. A second reason that I point to is when I read a lot of contemporary mothers' advice magazines in America Today and the advice books, one of the things I noticed was that there was this phenomenal and really quite absurd, even though I don't think you notice it as absurd when you have a young child, hyping of dangers that are just in the level of the ridiculous. But I think, for example, watch out what pogo stick you buy. Some of the springs might hurt your kid. Or an advice guide that says, oh, God, if your child gets a puncture wound to his brain, don't forget to take him to a doctor. It could make a terrible infection. This kind of sort of gratuitous advice that ends up serving as a system of scaring mothers way beyond, I think, what's useful. And I think that it isn't, however paranoid you might be tempted to be, it isn't because people really set out to scare moms. It's that they know that this stuff sells, that people will read material about dangers in a way that they'll buy and read almost nothing else. So we unintentionally end up creating an aura of fear.
I love the way you put this in the chapter entitled Worrying Mothers. In talking about media message, you say, there are no boundaries on the universe a mother must monitor.
Exactly.
You know, danger is at every hand. And in fact, you talk about how mothers, when we elevate them onto a pedestal, you talk about how there's something like there's 360 degrees directions in which a mother can fall off that pedestal.
No, that's right. And I think you put your finger on the third reason, thank you, that one of the things that happens in the world of motherhood is that in the 19th century when men begin to work out of the home, all of a sudden you get this cult of idealized motherhood. Now, a lot of people have written about it, but what's really important about it is that it is created out of whole cloth. It has no relationship to what a real mom could really do. And so if you start reading advice guides, say, in the 1830s in America, all of a sudden you get this message that says, you know what, George Washington was the greatest hero America ever had because his mother was so wonderful. And by the way, Lord Byron was the most sinful, scandalous poet ever alive in England because his mom was a decadent creep. So you get this aligning of what happens to sons with how moms behave. And what becomes so important about this is that the world of psychology and psychoanalysis, when it comes into its own in the maybe 80 or 100 years later, takes this mythology as fact. And it tries to create a social science around this gibberish about how the mom made it happen. And so the third reason that even though infant mortality disappears, moms don't feel a whole lot better is because we've created a fabric of myths about how much damage and good a mom can do, which is way above and beyond anything that's really possible.
Right. You also go on to say in kind of a related matter that in our current age that mothers are asked to love their child in exactly the right way. You say, with an optimally attuned love, correctly attached love, not selfish love or anxious love or passionate love or critical love, a perfect love in which all these different things are supposed to be balanced just right. And you say the impossibility of satisfying such a mandate makes many mothers feel unsure and inadequate. And little wonder.
No, you're right. And one of the funny things for me when I was talking with mothers, sort of sad and poignant, was that a mom would say to me, so what's this book about? And I'd start to tell her, and she'd say, is it going to make me feel worse? And I think that my mom feels so criticized because it's as if, I mean, think about sort of witchcraft for a minute or the witch trials in New England, that when the Salem witches were put on trial, the criteria by which they were charged were absolutely impossible for anybody to talk their way out of. You know, we saw you walking in this funny way. Or you're accused of things that you cannot, against which you can't defend yourself. And I think moms feel put in that same position in this culture, and I think they are. I think that because of the way we've popularized psychology and notions of mother damage, every mom feels that she can be accused in a million ways of failing in love.
Yes, of being either too protective or of being negligent
exactly.
Or someplace in between.
Or too this or too that. Or, you know, I mean, everybody has their complaint. And I think part of the problem is we probably put a whole lot too much emphasis on love as a cure-all in our culture. And certainly, you know, the sad thing is that many other variables affect how children do in the world. You know, what neighborhood they were born into, what public school or private school they go to, what genetic endowment for illnesses they have, millions of things. It's wonderful if we can love our children, but it isn't the only thing, and we make it the only thing in our public discourse, and I think this does terrible damage to mom.
That brings to mind another factor which you mentioned, the fact that, of course, the majority of contemporary women are either working outside the home or in other ways are very active outside the home, but many of them do so with this sort of gnawing sense that they maybe shouldn't be. You quote quite an article from the National Review by a Richard Lowry, who really lays into to women who drop off their children in daycare. What I think is interesting, I mean, I think we've all heard that perspective shared, and, you know, some of our listeners might even agree with it, but I think the point that you make that is so insightful is when you say that working mother's escalated guilt might have more negative effect on their children than the fact that she's working and away from the home.
No, I think that's right, and I think that if you imagine for a minute a mom who comes home from work, whether she's there because she wants to be working or because she has to be working, but she feels, oh, God, I'm a bad mom because I'm working. And the child says it at 8 o'clock at night when it's bedtime, oh, Mommy, you know, you can't put me to bed. You've been gone all day. I should be able to stay up two more hours. Well, a mom who feels guilty and that, you know, that she's really already failed for not being there, it's much harder for her to put that to rest and say, you know what, you need to go to bed, because the child has found a way to press the same button that the society is pressing. And it's not terribly wonderful for kids when we start dealing with them out of our guilt.
Right. You say children are brilliant at sensing parental uncertainty, self-doubt, or ambivalence, and I have a feeling you are not overstating that.
No, that's right. I think this is one of the many things my own sons taught me. You know, if a child comes to you at 3 in the afternoon and says, can I have an ice cream cone? And you say, oh, yeah, fine, 3 in the afternoon, that's fine. If they come to you at 5:30 in the evening and they say, can I have an ice cream cone? You think to yourself, maybe dinner, maybe not. No. But they instantly hear your uncertainty. So that instead of saying, all right, they say, oh, Mom, I'm starving. I mean, they know how to push on any bit of uncertainty that you have. And, of course, what's modern life but endless uncertainty?
You also mentioned the fact that contemporary demographics have something to do with the anxiety that grips so many mothers. The fact that more and more Americans have grown up in smaller families,
yes.
Meaning, well, at one point, for instance, you say so many adult children grow up only with the experience of having received, not given, child care.
Exactly. Isn't that, it is sort of amazing when you think about it. Probably until, you know, our generation or the one just before it, it was very unusual for a child to grow up in a family without enough siblings and enough demands on them to help raise the siblings, that by the time they would grow up, they would know, you know, a fair amount firsthand about young children. And that's completely disappeared. So when our kids were born, my husband and I thought we were receiving alien creatures from another planet. We were so anxious by the strangeness of what an infant was that it took us a long time to calm down enough to just raise it. And that was by no means our experience alone. I mean, I think that's a very common phenomenon now, and probably has its good news and its bad news in it. But, of course, the other piece of it is that whereas in the past every family had child loss just about, it was the exceptional family that didn't lose a child in many, many moments in history, they also had a number of children oftentimes, so that if a child died, at least there was another. And we're getting to a point now where that isn't true for many families.
Yes, the loss of a child in some way will have almost a more sweeping effect. You also talk about the fact that because children are now much more likely to survive than in years past, you say that there is less open communal expectation of child loss and less support for enduring it. A very interesting observation. What exactly are you saying there?
I think that in my work as a psychotherapist, one of the things that I really have learned across the last 20 years is that when parents lose children now, they are bereaved in a way that is just devastating. And part of that bereavement is their individual loss of their child. But part of it is that they feel that, why me? This has not happened to anybody else. No one else understands. Why was I singled out for this? So whereas in the past, at least there was the comfort of knowing that every other person in your town and village or city had lived through what you had lived through, now people feel like pariahs of a certain kind, as if they've been singled out for this terrible, terrible kind of misfortune.
We're talking with Jana Malamud-Smith. She is the author of a book entitled A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. Jana Malamud-Smith, one thing that is so compelling about this book is that you have taken a long time to search out much that has been written about motherhood over the centuries, actually. And it's very interesting, much of what you find, including all the way back to Greek drama. If you don't mind, I would rather focus, however, in the few minutes that remain, on some of the American writings a little closer to our own history, dating from the 1600s and 1700s. Some of what is written is just incredible.
It really is. Maybe we should just start with my favorite, the first book that I talk about. And what I try to do is talk about only a few books so that readers aren't overwhelmed by huge numbers of books, but to pick out ones that I think are typical. And in 1674, an English minister named John Flavel published a book which was an advice guide for a mother telling her how to mourn the death of her only son, which just is staggering to me as a book topic from that era, since advice guides were only just beginning. And this book sold very well, and I was able to take a look closely in the book at how well it sold in Boston and New England. It was sort of remarkable. It stayed in print for 120 years.
Which, wow.
Usually now a book stays in print for a year or two, so that tells us a lot. But in it, the minister tells the mothers, you know, gives them different pointers on how to grieve a dead child. But one of the things that just jumps out at you is at one point he says, you know, maybe it's your own fault your child died.
Mm. He says, the minister urges readers to look for unseen causes to examine their own impieties.
Exactly. And particularly, maybe you loved your son too much. Can you imagine? I mean, so that the poor grieving mother, on top of everything else, has to feel terrible that she loved and adored this child. And the minister implies that maybe you love the child more than you love God, and God got jealous and had to teach you a lesson. I mean, and, to add this to the burden of loss, and what I learned in reading these advice guides, and the reason I started with John Flavel, is that he becomes a template for what happens later, that when advice guides start to be written first by doctors and then by psychologists, even though all the information changes, the process of blaming mothers and threatening them for their own children's death does not change.
Right.
It just takes new forms.
Yes. From about the same era, you quote a book which sounds equally fascinating called A Token for Children by James Janeway.
Yes, this was a phenomenal bestseller in England and America, and it was a book to be read by children about, and mothers often read it, about the death of children. You know, in those days, the Puritans particularly used to say these horrendous things to children. They would say, you know, you're likely not to grow up. You're very likely to die. They might say to a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old, as an effort to get them to be more devout in the hopes of saving their souls. But what the book is, A Token for Children, is a series of stories about children dying and how they find faith in the process, but also about how much the mothers get chastised when they grieve their children.
Right. You say there that the way these stories are told, that the good children are often presented as being much wiser than their mothers.
Exactly. You know, the children end up saying to their mothers, oh, you can let me go. Don't grieve over me. I mean, it's heartbreaking material, but it also focuses again on the potency of this potent spell I write about, the way in which everybody recognizes that maternal attachment is a thing unto itself.
In the next chapter, you kind of take us into the next generation of books written, and they seem to be more and more written specifically with mothers in mind. And one of the points that you make in this chapter, as you quote some really unbelievable things, you say that authoritative writing about child rearing apparently required little personal experience. You cite that over and over again.
Right. One of the scary things you learn reading mother advice guides is almost none of them were written by people who'd actually mothered children. And so it seemed as if the freedom to have a strong opinion was in inverse proportion to what you really had in hands-on experience.
I have to quote one of the things that you quote in the book where, oh, now I'm not going to be able to find it, but you quote one of these advice guides. Here it is, where the author, I don't remember which book this is, I think it's a book by someone named Watson, and they are talking about what temperature the bathwater should be.
Yes, so this is Holt's book on children, yeah.
Oh, okay, The Care and Feeding of Children.
Yes.
And the answer to that question, at what temperature should the bath be given? For the first few weeks, at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Later, during early infancies, at 98 degrees Fahrenheit. After 6 months, at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. During the second year, from 85 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, this is being passed off as though it is science, as though it makes even a little bit of sense.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that this was an era when the doctors were trying very much to establish their authority and to say that there was a scientific answer to raising infants. And if moms just obeyed the scientists, they'd get it right. Well, they had to develop all this mishmash of pseudoscience in order to have something to tell moms. In fact, what's interesting about the text you just quoted, too, is that it then gets translated into psychology very quickly, whereas immediately Watson comes along and sees that Holt has written a bestseller and tries to do the same thing in psychology, and his outcome is even more horrendous. Mm.
You go on to give some advice to mothers, and you state really unequivocally that the best thing that a mother can give to a child, or the thing that a child needs more than anything, is a mother that, well, at first you might say free and happy, but especially that a mother is free, that a mother is not so weighed down by these kind of irrational fears and concerns that they cannot themselves be a vibrant, healthy human being.
That's right. And what I think I feel is, first of all, in any detailed way, I feel lucky when I match my socks in the morning, so I don't have a lot of on-high wisdom for moms. But what I really am trying to say to the culture is, look, children take their lead from how parents live their lives and view the world. And a mom who has been put inside the four walls of a room and told she can't go out in the world, she can't be a public citizen, she can't explore her own potential and contribute to her community and live her own life, whether she works at a day job or works at primarily at home. But a mother who is constricted is going to offer a constricted worldview to her children, because the world you see for yourself is the world that you give to your offspring. So it behooves us. It is really our responsibility in this world to do whatever we can to liberate and offer opportunity to all its citizens, but to remember that goes for mothers as well as everyone else.
You say in the book that mothers have their fears continually refreshed. At that moment in the book you're talking about, all that you read in Good Housekeeping or whatever the magazine might be, or in all these other ways, plus this whole history, this whole legacy of what mothers have been told down through the generations. What is your advice to a mother to help her escape that cycle of having her fears refreshed over and over again?
One of the reasons I wrote the book, one of the things I most hoped for in writing the book, was to comfort mothers and to tell them they weren't alone. And I think the only advice I really have is that if all of us as mothers begin to understand how deeply ruled we are by these feelings of putting children first and keeping them safe, maybe we can begin to hold them a little bit differently and get some perspective on them, so that we also can continue to make other choices in our lives that let us care for our children and let us live in the world.
Janet Malamud-Smith's book, once again, is called A Potent Spell, Mother Love and the Power of Fear. This interview first aired back in 2003. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking about an interesting documentary film that's going to be screened at Carthage College. Don't Turn Your Back on Friday Night. And it's based on the life of a very talented rock musician by the name of Ike Riley. Born and raised and still headquartered, if you will, in Libertyville, Illinois. And all three of his sons have gone to Carthage College. His youngest son is still there. And we'll be talking with Ike Riley and two of his sons, and with the director of this documentary film that traces the life and career of Ike Riley. That'll be tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, the author of a book called To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. And on Friday, I'll be speaking with an alum of Second City in Chicago, Julia Morales, who is going to be participating in a comedy improv event at the Racine Theater Guild this coming weekend. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sunny skies in our forecast today, with a high of 70 degrees, clear overnight, and a low of 43. Tomorrow, much like today, sunny and 69. Thursday, sunny, 71. We will warm up on Friday into the low 80s for a daytime high, back down into the 60s for the weekend, and sunshine remains. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.